Hey, it's Steve Imke. In the summer of 2017, I had the opportunity to spend a few hours with a class full of business entrepreneurs that wanted to learn how to conduct strategic planning for their business using the Business Model Canvas. I'm sorry you didn't make it, and I hope this is the next best thing. Here are excerpts from this live event. Hope you enjoy it and find it informative. But even more important, I hope it inspires you to get off the couch and do something with it. Thanks for listening. Industry forces. So we sit there and we talk about competitors. These are within my particular industry. So key competitors. Are those key competitors that I'm dealing with in my particular industry, are they becoming more numerous, or are they getting less numerous? Are they growing or fading? Are there dominant competitors that are coming out of there? Is there a competitive advantage that they may have based upon some of those physical resources and things that we talked about earlier? And are their cost structures similar to yours or different than yours? We also have what we'll call new entrants into a value chain. And so how many people here, I'm looking around here specifically, men, you have a lot of people here with watches. I no longer tell time with my watch anymore. I tell time with my cell phone. Quite frankly, that was a new entrant in a scenario that I probably wouldn't have looked at if I was a watch manufacturer. I wouldn't have thought that that's where my competition was going to begin to eliminate, the need for my particular product. So sometimes we have what we call value chain expansions. And if you think about mobile devices, I mean, they're expanding into everything. Right, so they're really no longer, we shouldn't really call them mobile phones, we should call them something else because they have such a big part of our lives these days. Do these barriers exist that are keeping new entrants from coming in? One of the things I often lament about is barbers. Now, I don't have anything bad to say about barbers, but quite frankly, I don't really think that we need to necessarily regulate barbers. But you can't become a barber unless you go to it's over 1,400 hours of class to become a barber. Now, that seems a bit excessive to me. Now, I can tell you essentially why that is, because quite literally it was just too easy to become a barber. I mean, when I was in the Coast Guard, for example, if you didn't volunteer, didn't get out of it, you became the ship's barber. Because, how bad could you screw up somebody's hair? It always grows back, right? It's just, there's not a whole lot. I can't imagine 1,400 hours. But what happened was it was so easy to get into that they said barbers got together and created a barrier and said, listen, we're gonna say we don't want every person to sit out there and be able to hang out a red, white, and blue twirly thing and say, hey, guess what? I'm a barber now. Right? We'd like to create this barrier. So sometimes we actually create these barriers to these groups to keep people out. And so they may be coming, that may be limiting people, new entrants into that business, or they may be leaving and driving people out. All right? And these new entrants may have a completely different value proposition than your value proposition because they've looked at it. So if I go back to some of the things we talked about before, I really didn't talk about the Cirque du Soleil model. But in the Cirque du Soleil, they did the same type of a thing with this business model canvas. Quite literally, they laid out the circus. Where was the pain points? Animals. It was painful to take animals from city to city, and not to mention that you had groups like PETA demonstrating you every time you went there. People would argue, what do you need these elephants sitting there in the middle of a parking lot in, Alaska, freezing because they're not in that particular thing, or, running around in a parking lot, or dragging them through town. They thought it was kind of a cruel and inhumane way. So they said, what if we got rid of the pain point, which was animals? What would we replace them with? And so literally Cirque du Soleil was born by laying out the traditional circus business model and said, where were we going to go make those changes? They said, hey, pain, let's remove the idea that we have to deal with animals. And what would we replace that with? Well, we'll double down on the artistic part of it. We'll create a more theatrical type of a scenario. And by the way, when we did that, we also changed the value or the customer segment in that scenario. We no longer were going after families with children. We are now going to go after more older, more mature audiences, and as a result of that, I don't need to sell those tickets for $25 anymore. I can sell them for $100. So you see how that can, how they can be used. But again, that's a different value proposition as they sit there and they look. So is a new entrant coming in and saying, I'm going to go take away your circus business because I have looked at a different business model and I have a different value proposition that I'm going to apply to that. And hence the reason for staples like Ringling Brothers retiring and no longer doing that because the value proposition underlining them kind of changed with the Cirque du Soleil model. All right, so as we continue along the industry forces here, substitute products and services. Are there replacement products? We've kind of delved into this a little bit as we've kind of discussed this point. Are there replacement products or services that I could actually buy, or am I locked in right now? Your costs versus their costs and ease of switching this again. These are, again, we're talking industry forces as a way to look at that. And then, and the final external factor that we're looking at here is what we'll call macroeconomic forces. So within we have certain market conditions, as we all know, businesses or segments go through boom bust cycles. They go through this expansion piece, they reach an apex, they go through this decline, and then they get reinvented and they kind of go through these different cycles. And so where are we with respect to a boom and bust cycle? So if you were in the construction business in 2006, things were really good. In 2008, not so good. As I mentioned earlier, we have both global and local economies that we have to kind of figure out. I mentioned earlier about the difference in population, let's say, between a Boca Raton and a Silicon Valley. Unemployment, market conditions, right? If you're a city, do you want to have high unemployment or low unemployment? I mean, ideally, in one respect, you want to have low unemployment. That means more people are buying stuff and paying more in sales taxes and everything else to help run your city. But at the same time, it's hard to recruit new people to kind of come in there. Do you know of the 50 states, do you know which state has the lowest unemployment rate? Colorado. Do you know what state has the highest? Alaska. Just FYI. So unemployment, they change based upon that. So each city, not only Colorado is unique, but actually Colorado Springs is actually lower than I think the national or the state average as well. So, you know, all those things have a factor. If I'm going to be a business and I'm a manufacturing company, I may want to move to Pueblo where the unemployment is a little bit higher than I might move to, let's say, Colorado Springs where I don't get as many people. We're trying to incorporate lots of cyber companies here. And the question is, if there's nobody to go ahead and be employed, that's kind of difficult to do that. You'll see a lot of businesses will set up around colleges and universities because that becomes a feeder system to give new employees as they continue to grow, right? So capital markets is another macroeconomic forces. Is there a propensity out there for debt? All right, are banks sitting on lots of cash that they want to lend, or is cash in short supply and something that they want to hoard and not give out? And you remember how those things kind of changed through various economic cycles. We got very tight with how we were going to go and distribute cash, but before the housing bubble, banks were eager to lend lots of it. So there was lots of debt capital out there, and people were getting 100% or even getting second mortgages that were exceeding the value of their underlying security, which was their house, to be able to do that. Capital markets were very big. Talk about 2 years later, it was difficult to buy a house without putting 20% down. So that market had quite literally dried up. So we have risk in terms of debt capital issues, but we also have risk capital, which is where people are investing, equity people. So if you think about things like Shark Tank, well, these are investors, these are angel investors investing in your particular business. And so certainly within the confines of local as well as global, are there more high net worth people eager to invest in your particular business, or is that something that people are shying away from and hoarding more of their money because they don't really think that there's good opportunities out there, or their returns are better in some other market than they are somewhere else? And then, of course, we have the cost of funds. Those are maybe related to interest rates or down payments or terms that the lenders will require, as well as, even if it was risk capital, how much equity I have to exchange to get that investment from that shark, if we will, or somebody along that line. Within macroeconomic forces, we also have commodities and other resources that may be affected. The cost of oil, if I have a business that runs very heavily on fuel costs and the cost of fuel is low, that means I have better margins. If anybody will recall, when oil prices were at 120 and above, all of a sudden my garbage collectors started hitting me with a fuel surcharge. I'm not even sure, it still might be on my bill. I may never have even taken it off. But because it cost them so much, because it was $4 a gallon to get fuel, they said, hey, we got to charge you a fuel surcharge on top of that to go off and do that. Same with labor as well as raw materials that are out there. So when raw materials become in short supply, we'll have to pay more for them and so on. And if they become abundant, then those prices kind of go down. You know, supply and demand issues, basic economics. Are they easy or hard to obtain? They may be different than the price, but it may be more difficult to obtain a particular resource, even though the prices haven't changed much, just because of maybe some regulatory issues, and of course the cost of those particular products. And lastly, we have economic infrastructure types of situations. And I'm always reminded, I used to be a director for entrepreneurship here at Pikes Peak Community College. And one of the things that, we would always talk about is that Colorado Springs was like the redheaded stepchild of Denver. And how we, from an ecosystem standpoint, we want it to be more like Denver. As I was driving through Denver on a day like today where it was like 90 degrees, and I'm thinking there and I'm stuck in traffic sitting outside of Invesco Field or whatever they call that now. I'm sweating and I'm sitting in traffic at noon in the afternoon. I'm sitting there saying, there is a reason I don't live here. And that has a lot to do with transportation and ecosystems that exist there. I don't necessarily like that congestion. I mean, I'm a New York guy. I mean, I grew up right outside of Manhattan. You'd think I'd kind of do that. I don't live there anymore because I prefer to live more rural, but I'm not farm rural. I kind of try to find something that is just right for me, right? It's like the porridge is too hot, it's too cold, but there's one that's just right, and that's kind of where we want to fit. So economic infrastructure with respect to transportation, light rail in Denver is a pretty interesting thing. Growing up in New York, you didn't need a vehicle because you take subways and buses and all that kind of public transportation. You didn't have to take a taxi here if you want to get from one end of town to the other. You got some buses that you can possibly take, maybe an Uber taxi or something, but you just don't have the same kind of public transportation options that you do in places like Denver and stuff. So infrastructure does have its a play into, as we sit down and we start looking at some macroeconomic forces. Income and sales tax rates. So each state, for example, has a different income tax rate for people. That dictates whether I'd rather live in one state than another. Or if I had a business, whether my business is more economically advantaged by living in one state that has a lower tax rate than somebody who has a higher tax rate. And like I said, we talked about public service types of things, which is like light rails, subway systems in cities like New York and stuff like that, or I've heard them talking about building, one of those 200-mile-an-hour bullet trains that will actually connect not only Cheyenne, Wyoming, all the way to Houston, Texas. That'll open that up. And of course, the last piece is quality of life issues. And this is a point that I remember when my kids who grew up here, one of them moved to Bentonville, Arkansas, which, by the way, the cost of living is significantly less there. It's actually not a really bad place to live if you don't have allergies. But quite frankly, I mean, they invest a lot. Walmart invests quite a bit of money into that. And unlike, you think about Walmart people here, I mean, the people that work in the stores don't necessarily get paid a lot. But I'm telling you what, the corporate places, there's a lot of money out there. Plus, a really nice house there is $250,000. And you buy that same house up here, it's going to cost you at least $500,000 to buy that exact same house here. And but by the same token, you earn a lot less there than you do here. So, but it's all related on quality of life issues that you go in there. So this is kind of, we've really kind of talked about all the elements that I want to introduce to you with respect to the business model canvas. So effectively, this concludes the part of the lesson here.
Thank you for listening to Strategic Planning Using the Business Model Canvas. To learn more about Stephen Imke or to learn more about what it takes to own and operate a small business, please visit stevebizblog.com. That's stevebizblog.com. Or look for Steve's many books on various aspects of small business ownership at amazon.com or on stevebizblog.com.